The Bloomberg news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Almost a third of British consumers are planning to reduce spending on Christmas in 2023 as the burden of lofty inflation weighs on shoppers. By contrast, according to research from PwC, only 18% of the British public intend to spend more during the holidays than they did in 2022. The Christmas season can be a make-or-break period for retailers who rely on shoppers to splurge on gifts, food and drinks for celebration with family and friends. Around 80% of those who plan to spend less blamed rising food and energy costs, while over 20% cited the challenge of mortgage payments and rent payments. Inflation in Britain slowed to an 18-month low in August, but prices remain elevated and fewer than a third of the adults surveyed by PwC described their household finances as healthy. According to PwC, more people have begun their Christmas shopping earlier than in previous years to help budget for purchases, with one in five having started by mid-September. Lisa Hooker, industry leader for consumer markets at PwC, said, with shoppers wanting to protect spending on family and special occasions, they're starting preparations early and being cautious. Last year, shoppers did spend more than expected, so with falling headline inflation, there may yet be a last-minute spending uptick. Retailers will certainly be on tenterhooks.
The conversation. Hi, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we look at the topic of our fragile peace process. How does peace now look 25 years on from the signing of the Good Friday Agreement? Has common ground been made by former enemies, or are we as polarised as ever? My next guest served under the Royal Ulster Constabulary. Depending on which side of the political divide you come from, the RUC were seen as the protectors of a community or an oppressive force against another. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildernew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Sam Thompson. Sam is a former member of the Royal Ulster Constabulary. He experienced the loss of a number of colleagues and friends and saw numerous killings and bombings during the conflict. Sam retired in 2008 and has expanded on his love of history and is now a lecturer. Sam, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you, Sean.
So, Sam, you grew up not far from where we're sitting now, a very different place from this side of the wall. Do you want to tell us a bit about your childhood?
Yes, well, I came in this world, I was born in the Royal Victoria Hospital up the road. But the first house I was brought home to is Dundee Street, just on the other side of the Peace Line. So all four of my grandparents all lived within about 300 yards from here. My grandfather would have grown up on 9th Street, which runs down into Conway Street. So I was very familiar with that lower Shankill area when I was young, even though my parents moved to Ballysillan. My grandparents continued to live down there, so I was basically brought up in between the two.
And Sam, you joined the RUC. What motivated you to do that, and what was its reputation like when you joined it?
Right, in terms of motivation, I joined it pretty much by default. I didn't really know what to do with my life, and I'm now at the stage where I'm retired and I still don't really know what to do with it.
What year did you join and what age were you?
I joined in 1979 and I was 18 and about 4.5 months by the time I went in. So it was basically the economy here was imploding. The place was rapidly deindustrialising, and it was one of the few things that had any job security. Now, in terms of reputation, there was none of the baggage in the unionist community regarding the RUC. And my first memory of them is actually quite a positive one. I went to Cliftonville Primary School, and it must have been either 1970 or 1971. Our school sports day was attacked by bigger kids from around the Bone area. And the teachers got us off with all the rum, like they're coming over and chucking bricks and stuff at us, and feeling absolutely terrified. And the police arrived down in the school, and I remember feeling reassured and safe at the sight of the police uniform. Now, as I got older, 1970s was quite a brutal period, and up around Ballysillan, and I don't know whether it's true or not, but like the word in the school was, if you messed about with Tennant Street or you got arrested, you would get a hiding. And as this will sound absolutely weird to many viewers, but the idea that if you're arrested, you're going to get beaten up by the police, nobody thought this was strange. But on the unionist side of the house, that was very much a thing too. Things have to change, so you can either say, well, that's the way things are, or you can try and change them in a more positive way.
And once you joined the RUC, I'm sure you remember the RUC for 28 years then?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was there a certain period or a time where, and I'm sure there were many dark times, mm-hmm. was there something that stuck out in particular?
Oh, well, there were so many things, like particularly the first lot of years when I was in uniform. You remember like the severe incidents when people have been shot and things like that, and all these sort of bloody things, they tend to stick in your mind. The thing which travels with me the most, and I wasn't even there, was my best friend was killed during the hunger strike. And this is why this sort of Republican celebration of it tends to stick in me a bit. There's a lot of people died during that didn't want to die. And he was blown up on the 7th of September, blown to pieces basically, only identifiable by fingerprints, just turned 20 years of age. And he had been transferred to Pomeroy, and that was his first day on duty. He was there for an hour and 5 minutes. And I still think about him and about that quite often. And then there's other people that know quite well as well. But, you know, you carry these things through your life.
I think we're all scarred by what happened. And I suppose during your time in the RUC, did you ever have the urge to join a paramilitary organisation or were you ever pressurised to do
absolutely
that?
Absolutely not. And even when I was growing up in Ballysillan, which where paramilitaries are very strong, I had absolutely no inclination of it. I can give you a story about how people did get into those sort of things. And so about when I was 16, myself and a friend, we went, but heard that there's this bar in Shankill Road to serve you. Weren't too fussy about what age you were. It's a brown bar facing Shankill Library. So we went in, ordered a couple of pints of harp, sitting there at a table thinking we're great guys. And then somebody comes over and starts, "You all right, fellas?" Starts chatting to you, and I realise what this all is, where you're from, all this sort of crack, who's your father and all this, trying to figure out whether you're Catholics or not. Like, I don't think anybody who's Catholic's going to be daft enough to go in there. And I say, "Well, what do you think? This place?" "Aye, fine, it's all right." Sure, we can swear you in tomorrow." I says, "What do you mean, swear us in?" He says, "You're joining, aren't you?" I says, "Joining what?" He says, "The UVF." And they're spat my beer out. So it was the first time I'd been in this place in my life. And within 10 minutes of walking in the door, somebody coming over trying to get me to join the UVF. Of course, I never went back near the place. But that would give you some idea how easy it was for people to get involved and that sort of thing.
And just on that, Sam, we're all shaped by our lived experiences.
100%.
And I understand you served in Springfield Road.
Yeah.
Barracks, as we had called it, Springfield Road Police Station.
Yeah.
That, to me, as a child growing up, was a place, you know, you heard stories of family members being tortured, even friends of mine that were in there were beaten. And to me, as a child growing up, the RUC were the enemy. But obviously, you had different lived experiences. You were inside there, looking out.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, it's just, it's 1983, and I arrived up in there not too long after the hunger strike. And the place had a very forbidden appearance. It didn't have the blast wall around it then. It just had this wire outside. And the reason it didn't have a blast wall was they put a bomb out there that would wreck hundreds of houses around it, because it was a rare place. You were right in the middle of people. And the yard of it had a big corrugated tin fence, and there was holes in it from where somebody had chucked the hand grenade over. And on a quiet evening, you could be standing out there in the front yard, and you could hear the televisions of people in Violet Street and their living rooms were seriously about 6 or 7 feet from the front yard. So, like, the noise that they must have had from all the police and army vehicles, and it was primarily an army post. Like, the RUC were down in one corner of it. And the army occupied about 80% of the building. So you had, like, army pigs and stuff like that parked about inside it. The army did the security. And then now and again, it was overrun by feral cats. And you'd get these squatties running about drowning cats in the toilets and stuff. Like, it was unreal. But in the inquiry office, you had, like, these bulletproof shutters over the windows. There was no natural light. And then behind it, you had all these old newspapers, must have been stuff to keep the draft out. One day I pulled them out, like, and they were dated from 1972 and stuff like that. As a working environment, it was horrible. It was cramped. The facilities, you know, were grim. It was dangerous. It was noisy. But probably the best bunch of people I've ever worked with there.
We chatted earlier, you had mentioned, and I was amazed at the at the knowledge you had of RUC men and British Army personnel that were killed just around Springfield Road. Do you want to tell us?
Well, for a start, a George Cross was one in the inquiry office in 1972 when a paratrooper threw himself in a bomb which had been dumped in there. Shortly before I arrived, there's a soldier killed at the Cavendish Street entrance by an RPG-7, a guy I worked with. He is the first one down to attend to him. And the warhead of the RPGs apparently went through the wall, the Sanger, and lodged inside him. Again, the year before, 3 soldiers had been shot dead by an M60 machine gun around the corner in Arras Street. 1979, there was a RUC officer shot dead as they reversed the Land Rover out the front gate, and I think somebody had counted it up that there must have been about more than 20 members of security forces killed within about 30 yards of the front gates of the place. And along the front of the building was, like, riddled with bullet holes where cars used to drive up and down and spray the place.
Sam, you also served in Tyrone. Are there any... Was it very different serving along the border, and are there any particular stories or reminiscences that you have from that time?
Yeah, well, rural areas are very different from urban ones. In Tyrone, as a sergeant in the mobile support unit, so though we backed up the local police in Dungannon, we also could be all over the place. Like, we went up to Belfast, up at Ainsworth Avenue, the time the UVF guy blew himself up at Emma Prater. But Dungannon changed me. At 1 week, whereas within about 25 feet of three bombs inside a week, none of which went off properly. I remember thinking, I can't do this anymore, I need to get out of this. Because it wasn't too long after two friends that Colleen McMurray used to work with in Armagh, she had been killed in Newry. And another guy, probably nobody's ever heard of, a guy called Billy Evans, he ironically was killed by the army, out the foot patrol up near New Barnsley, and an army Land Rover ran over and killed him. I remember speaking to him a few months before, saying, look, get out of there. I don't believe in much, but I believe in the law of averages, and if you push your luck too long, sooner or later something's going to happen to you. So I think the deaths of those two were preying on my mind, and I thought, I need to get a job in headquarters or something, you know, because I'd gone through all these years of sort of near misses and something happening to somebody changed the shift with me and seeing things happen to other people, and I thought, it's only a matter of time before it happens to me. So applied for job and training and got that.
We crossed our own paths, me and yourself, through a reconciliation,
yeah.
An informal, let's say, reconciliation programme.
Yeah.
How has it been for you on that kind of journey in reconciliation?
It hasn't made a profound difference. You know, I think as you get older, you start to reflect on life. And there's an old saying, if you think the same at 40 as you did in 20, you've wasted 20 years. And I started this interview by saying I basically come from a couple hundred yards away. And the thought occurred to me one day, the idea that someone should be an eternal enemy because they happen to be born 200 yards away from you or born on the other side of a street from you is absolutely absurd. It's absurd. But that's the situation that we find ourselves in here. So I thought of that, and again, occasionally you see these little inspirational quotes, which may or may not be true. There's one supposed to be from Martin Luther King, said that hating someone is like drinking poison and hoping they'll die. Look, I could hit Michelle all I want. You're probably not even going to know, but it's not going to affect your life, but it'll affect mine. And is it going to make me any happier? No. Will it bring anyone back? No. Is it going to make the future any better for people that are children now or unborn? No. So some people, that's their way to get through life, is carrying grudges and resentments and hate. I just think it doesn't do any good, and it wasn't making me feel any better. You know, I, by and large, don't suffer from PTSD or anything like that anymore, and I think this has helped because, in my mind, the war's over. There's other people can't accept that it's over for many, many reasons, some entirely legitimate. They've suffered a lot worse than I have. But as far as I'm concerned, it's the right thing to do. It's not going to change the world, but I think it's up to each and every individual to do their own little bit.
I agree with you, Sam. I think hate is a very negative emotion and very wasteful. And, you know, we all have to move on. So where do you stand on the reunification question? Have you thought about our future politically?
These days I'm pretty agnostic on it. I was always, I suppose, a small U unionist. I wasn't a diehard. Like, I agreed with a statement I heard quite early in my time in the police, where somebody says to me, I'm not too bothered about a United Ireland. What I am bothered about is somebody trying to bomb me into it. Any sort of affection I had for the union died on the morning of the Brexit referendum. That to me is a watershed moment. Because that to me showed it doesn't matter what we think here, you know, it's what England wants, really. I know people say it's a UK-wide referendum, but there's no way that Scotland and Northern Ireland should have been forced out against this will. As Scotland in particular is like a distinct country and all the rest of it. And I also just think it's incredibly stupid. I think that the UK, basically, that they decided to commit suicide. And I'm convinced of that. I think that historians will look back, that is the day when the Union was fatally wounded, and it was a self-inflicted wound.
And on that, what would you like to see from Republicans to go that extra bit that would maybe convince you that reunification would be an option?
I see a bit of schizophrenia from Republicanism. On the one hand, there's this outreach, we want peace. But on the other, there's this sort of like constant propaganda war, which is still being waged, and quite a bit of hostility, continually refighting the troubles. And at some stage, this is going to have to stop. You know, unionists who had relations in the police or UDR aren't going to look upon their relatives as evil child killers any more than relatives. The IRA men are going to regard their relatives and that. And all it's doing is winding people up and giving people an excuse not to talk to them. I think as a society, and I'm not just pointing the finger at Republicans here, it's all over. We need to stop absolutely wallowing in the past. We're not remembering it, we're wallowing in it. You know, I did an article once that Japan recovered from 2 atom bombs quicker than Northern Ireland's recovered from the Troubles. 15 years after Hiroshima, they were hosting the Olympics and are one of the best economies in the world, because they just decided we're not going to talk about all this, we're just going to move on, make a better country.
You're still tuned into The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. I'm joined by my co-host, Michelle Gildenew, alongside historian and former RUC man, Sam Thompson.
All right. So, close to where you were born and brought up, yeah. Sam, there's a massive community festival, yeah, called Feel and Bubble, and that came out of remembering internment,
yeah,
and then it became a community, yeah, festival as a more positive way of remembering the past. So, you know, do you think that something like that could be replicated? I know it looks at and speaks to people from all political persuasions and none, and it's just such an inclusive festival. Do you know, attended any events?
I have indeed. I've attended events in the past, and I think it's a very positive thing, because, as I said, I arrived in Springfield Road 40 years ago, and I remember those annual internment things, and it was sort of like that film The Purge. You know, the civilians sort of took it upon the night, anything goes, from both them and the police. Like, there was batting rounds fired in, and they could be written off in a form, which any other time of the year would be, what did you do that for? But those internment nights, it was like ritualistic rioting. And you had people hurt, and you had people occasionally getting killed. So I think that's I'll give credit where it's due. That's marvellous credit, primarily to Sinn Féin, for turning that round, to have a very destructive time into something more positive. Some of the events are more cross-community than others, but that's okay. You know, if I don't want to go to something, I won't. You know, it's like the annual Bobby Sands March, you know, in May or whatever. It doesn't bother me, because I don't have to go anywhere near it. So, yeah, that's good, and I would like to see that being extended across the Shankill and East Belfast, and maybe have a whole summer of cultural events. But, you know, I think those events are worthwhile, because you've now got, you know, unionists going to them, and one of the commentators is going along, and it's letting also people in West Belfast speak directly to people that they wouldn't normally speak to. So I think it's all generally quite positive. I know there's a bit of controversy about one or two things, but by and large, I approve of it.
This week, we take a look at the history of partition. How was Ireland divided, and what has that meant for the population of the North over this last 100 years?
The official partitioning of Ireland took place in May 1921 via an act passed by the British Parliament. The original intention was for both regions to remain within the United Kingdom, but the Irish War of Independence led to the South seceding from the UK in 1922. Attempts at legislating the Government of Ireland Act first began in 1886. The Government of Ireland Act of 1920 was the fourth try at establishing Home Rule in Ireland. That is, affording the country a certain amount of freedom to self-govern while retaining its position as part of the United Kingdom. Up to that point, Ireland had been ruled by the UK Parliament via their administration at Dublin Castle, ever since the Irish Parliament was abolished through the Acts of Union 1800. After many attempts at negotiating the division of the 9 northerly counties of Ulster from the 23 remaining counties that comprise Munster, Leinster and Connacht, only 6 counties within Ulster were included in the 4th Irish Home Rule Bill of 1920. This was to ensure a Protestant majority for many years to come. After the 3rd Home Rule Bill was passed in 1912, Ulster Unionists had founded a paramilitary force named the Ulster Volunteer Force, with the intention of resisting the bill's implementation by violent means. Many British Army officers stationed in Ireland resigned, and with nationalists having established their own military army in response, with both sides importing arms, a civil war seemed imminent. Eventually, a trial period of partition was also included in the third version of the Irish Home Rule Bill to appease Unionists, but when World War I broke out in 1914, the bill was suspended. In an attempt to take advantage of Britain's distraction with the war, an insurrection was launched by Irish revolutionaries on Easter 1916. Following this rebellion, more attempts were made to reach a compromise, such as the 1917-18 Irish Convention in Dublin, with little success. In 1919, the Irish War of Independence officially began. The Government of Ireland Act was enacted in 1920, and the island was partitioned the following year. Home rule never came into effect in the south. Instead, the Anglo-Irish Treaty of 1921, which ended the war in Ireland, allowed the self-governing Irish Free State to be created, and thus the partitioning of Ireland became official.
And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme to help us grow our audience across all our social media platforms. I'd like to thank our special guest, Sam Thompson, and our resident co-host, Michelle Gildenew. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Limelight.
Former US President Donald Trump and one of the leading contenders for the 2024 presidential race now claims that lawyer Sidney Powell never represented him, despite previously claiming that she was among his wonderful lawyers and representatives. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Former U.S. President Donald Trump now claims that the lawyer Sidney Powell never represented him. Former President Donald Trump looked to create some separation between himself and a lawyer that he had said worked for him amid his legal trouble in Georgia, as he continues to deny all wrongdoing. After Sidney Powell, an attorney who vocally backed Donald Trump's baseless election fraud conspiracies, last week pleaded guilty in Fulton County, Georgia, election subversion case, Donald Trump took to social media claiming that Sidney Powell was never his lawyer and went on to repeat false claims about the 2020 presidential race. Despite the fake news reports to the contrary, and without even reaching out to ask the Trump campaign, Ms. Powell was not my attorney and never was, Donald Trump posted on his social media platform. That post flies in the face of a November 2020 announcement from Donald Trump in which he named Sidney Powell as an addition to his legal team. He tweeted on 14th of November 2020 that Sidney Powell was added to our other wonderful lawyers and representatives. Sidney Powell has admitted to 6 misdemeanor charges in the Georgia case over efforts to overturn Donald Trump's loss in that state. As part of the agreement, Sidney Powell must testify truthfully about any co-defendants involved in the case, according to the judge. Donald Trump, a co-defendant, has pleaded not guilty to his own charges. Sidney Powell, one of 18 co-defendants in former President Donald Trump's election interference case in Georgia, has taken a plea deal in which she has agreed to testify in the case. She is pleading guilty to 6 misdemeanor charges, according to the agreement read in court on Thursday. She will get 12 months of probation for each count, as well as a $6,000 fine. As part of the agreement, Sidney Powell must testify truthfully about any co-defendants involved in the case and provide all documents to the district attorney's office relevant to their case against the other co-defendants, according to Fulton County Judge Scott McAfee. Steve Sado, Donald Trump's lead counsel in the Georgia case, responded to Sidney Powell's plea deal by telling ABC News in a statement, "Assuming truthful testimony in the Fulton County case, it will be favorable to my overall defense strategy." In a social media post on Sunday, Donald Trump sought to distance himself from Sidney Powell, claiming she was not my attorney and never was. However, on numerous occasions, Donald Trump previously referred to her as being part of his legal team. For example, he tweeted on 14th of November 2020 that Sidney Powell was added to our other wonderful lawyers and representatives, and she appeared alongside Donald Trump campaign lawyers Rudy Giuliani and Jenna Ellis at a 19th of November 2020 press conference about alleged voter fraud in the 2020 election, where Rudy Giuliani called them representatives of Trump and the Trump campaign's legal team. Donald Trump's lawyers distanced themselves from Sidney Powell shortly after, on 22nd of November 2020, arguing she was practicing on her own, even though she continued to join in on meetings in the Oval Office. According to financial disclosure filings, the Trump campaign, his allied Political Action Committee, and the Republican National Committee, the RNC, don't appear to have paid any legal expenses to Sidney Powell. Sidney Powell's plea came a day before she was scheduled to go on trial along with co-defendant Kenneth Chesbrough. The cable news network CNN has also covered the same story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump claimed that Sidney Powell was never his attorney in a social media post on Sunday, 22nd of October, 3 days after she pleaded guilty in the Georgia election subversion case. Despite Donald Trump's claims, Sidney Powell was briefly an official member of Donald Trump's legal team in 2020, and Trump stayed in contact with her on election-related matters even after she was ousted from his campaign. Sidney Powell was one of millions and millions of people who thought, and in ever-increasing numbers still think correctly, that the 2020 presidential election was rigged and stolen, and our country is being absolutely destroyed because of it. Ms. Powell was not my attorney and never was. In fact, she would have been conflicted, Donald Trump wrote on his social media platform Truth Social. Donald Trump's attempts to distance himself from Sidney Powell comes after she agreed to cooperate with Fulton County prosecutors and testify against her co-defendants in the case, potentially including Donald Trump. Trump publicly announced on 15th of November 2020 that he added Sidney Powell to his truly great team of lawyers working on the election. She participated in a notorious Trump campaign press conference alongside fellow Trump lawyers Rudy Giuliani and Jenna Ellis, where she peddled unfounded conspiracy theories about an international vote-rigging plot to flip millions of votes from Donald Trump to Joe Biden. The Trump campaign soon dropped her from the legal team and insisted that she was practicing law on her own. She went on to file frivolous lawsuits across the country in hopes of overturning the results of the 2020 election. One federal judge later said Sidney Powell's actions were a historic and profound abuse of the judicial process. And she met up with Donald Trump on multiple occasions, including a December 2020 White House meeting where he considered naming her as a special counsel to look for voter fraud. This was the infamous meeting where there was discussion of declaring martial law and ordering the US military to seize voting machines. As Sidney Powell's trial approaches in Georgia, she similarly tried to distance herself from Donald Trump. Her attorney said she did not represent President Trump or the Trump campaign because she never signed an engagement agreement to be their attorney. Her name was never on any court filings from the Trump campaign, Sidney Powell's lawyers pointed out. In her guilty plea, Sidney Powell admitted her role in the January 2021 breach of election systems in rural Coffee County, Georgia. With the help of local Republican officials, a group of Trump supporters accessed and copied information from the county's election systems in hope of somehow proving that the election was rigged against Donald Trump. They did this after Trump declined to sign an executive order directing the Pentagon to seize the voting machines.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Tried to suppress the voice of the Palestinians. Common catchphrases, all-out support for Israel, unwavering support, and the likes. But finally, the world is not buying it. No amount of media coverage can cover up the Israeli crimes, including America's all-out support.
And we stand with the Palestinians, and we stand with Arabs. And they try and change the narrative because you own the narrative, see? This is our problem. You own the narrative. You own the United Nations. You own Hollywood. You own all these mouthpieces. Where are our voices? Our voices need to be heard as well. We've been watching your channel. And instead of mourning our dead, instead of mourning these Palestinian children, we've been having to deal with more dehumanization of Arabs.
And the proof that the tide is turning are in the worldwide protests.
Free Palestine!
So we are
are here just to show the support for our people in Gaza.
What we're experiencing today, it's happening in Palestine, is a genocide.
I'm here because I'm a Jew born in Jerusalem, and I'm horrified and enraged that my government here in the U.S. is sending weapons and money and never-ending unconditional diplomatic support for Israel.
The world rallying behind Palestinians and Palestine. And it's not because Israel is murdering Palestinians, mostly women and children. Just think about it. How can this war bring out so many people from all corners of the world in such high numbers? It's because the world has been educated, it's informed now, it has witnessed four wars before, and it has seen the daily oppression and killing of Palestinians under an apartheid regime. Now U.S. politicians are speaking in a way that they haven't before.
Congresswoman representing the Massachusetts 7th Congressional District.
Where is your humanity? How do you look at one atrocity and say this is wrong? But you watch as bodies pile up, as neighborhoods are leveled. Israel has dropped more bombs in the last 10 days than we dropped in a whole year in Afghanistan. Where is your humanity? Where is your outrage? Where is your care?
The passion in her voice from an American politician is for life and how it's being snuffed out, taken away with a missile, ones that are made in the USA. Since the war started, 45 cargo planes transported weapons from the US to Israel. Among the military aid, around 1,000 tons of armaments, including 155-millimeter artillery shells, military vehicles, and supplies.
To President Biden and his administration, generations will not forget, and history will be recorded, that it was your administration, your billions of dollars, your support with weapons of mass destruction.
A veteran U.S. State Department official quit over what he described as the Biden administration's intellectual bankruptcy, in which he said Biden is rushing to provide arms to Israel, which is short-sighted, destructive, unjust, and contradictory to the very values that we publicly espouse. A CBS poll asked whether the U.S. should send weapons to Israel. More than half the respondents said that it should not. That is another first. And while we are on first-time occurrences, this is a first, which occurred at the Human Rights Council session in Geneva. The council members turned their back to the American ambassador's speech in Geneva. This happened during her speech preaching about human rights, while America's all-out support and bombs were killing Palestinians as she was speaking. The true face of the Israeli regime and the U.S. backing has rocked the U.S. status quo when it comes to Israel. Widespread attempts to suppress pro-Palestinian voices have reached unprecedented levels in the U.S. The cancellation of major conferences, demands for the dismissal of workers who express support for Palestinians, and intimidation campaigns against Arab American voices critical of Israeli policies are just some examples. This has even affected U.S. lawmakers, like Senator Elizabeth Warren, once a U.S. presidential candidate, in which more than 260 of her staffers signed an open letter demanding that she call for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, describing Israel as increasingly fascist, that commits war crimes and enforces a brutal apartheid, calling for an immediate ceasefire. But only certain U.S. lawmakers have the guts to openly support Palestine.
You know what's so hard sometimes is watching those videos and the people telling the kids don't cry and like let them cry. And they're shaking and some of you know this, they keep telling them not to cry in Arabic. They can cry. I can cry. We all can cry. If we're not crying, something is wrong. And so I'm telling you right now, President Biden, not all America's with you on this one.
Previous Israeli crimes are no secret. Khanna, 1996. Israel bombed a UN shelter, killing 106 civilians, mostly kids. Israel was never held accountable. Lebanon, 1982. The Sabra and Shatila massacre resulted in the killings of between 2,000 and 3,500 Palestinian refugees and Lebanese civilians in 2 days in the city of Beirut. Previous massacres of Palestinians by Israel have been etched in people's minds, especially the wars on the Gaza Strip, which is why the BDS movement, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction, requires a reboot, one to include Israeli officials, including the pilots who dropped the bombs, on the Palestinians. After all, now is the time that sanctioning Israeli products could prove successful, since Israel's economy is tanking due to the war. We mentioned a couple of first-time incidents before. Here's another. Thousands of Muslims praying in front of the U.S. Congress to demand a ceasefire in Gaza. A scene that creates a sense of deja vu. For this is reminiscent of how Palestinians have prayed in front of the Al-Aqsa Mosque in their future capital. Since the beginning of the latest spate of violence between Israel and Palestinian resistance fighters in the Gaza Strip, Western countries and the U.S. in particular have voiced their unequivocal support for Israel and ignored the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people. The U.S. President Joe Biden visited Israel on Wednesday amid an intensified Israeli campaign of airstrikes on Gaza, the most densely populated strip of land in the world, which has killed thousands of Palestinians, injuring over 13,000. Biden has unequivocally defended the Israeli regime's ongoing genocide in the coastal Gaza Strip. Biden said Washington would provide the embattled regime with everything it needed to, quote, defend itself.
For decades, we've ensured Israel's qualitative military edge. And later this week, I'm going to ask the United States Congress for an unprecedented support package for Israel's defense.
The U.S. president promised to ask Congress for an unprecedented military aid package for Israel to assist its ongoing war on Gaza. Reports indicated that Biden was considering a supplemental request of about $10 billion for Israel. It is now feared that the U.S. President Joe Biden's unflinching backing of Israeli aggression against Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip could give the Tel Aviv regime the green light to commit mass atrocities and genocide against the people of Palestine. It is now reported that Joe Biden has told the Israeli Prime Minister that Washington is fully in support of Tel Aviv's plans to launch a ground invasion of the besieged Gaza Strip. Earlier this week, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, highlighted the role of the U.S. in Israel's ongoing atrocities against the Palestinian people. Ayatollah Khamenei noted that numerous pieces of information suggest that the U.S. is formulating the current policy within the Zionist regime. The U.S. was the sole vote against the resolution on Wednesday. Reports say the Pentagon, if need be, will deploy virtually 2,000 troops to Israel to assist the occupying regime with its war on the besieged Gaza Strip. The boots on the ground are said to be tasked with providing advisory and medical support only. The specifics, the where and when of the deployment, remain unclear. The report comes after the Pentagon said it was moving another carrier group to the Mediterranean, the USS Dwight D. Eisenhower Strike Group. Combined force of more than 5,000 sailors will join the USS Gerald Ford, which arrived off the coast of Israel last week. The Biden administration has rejected Arab calls for de-escalation or ceasefire, rendering the U.S. complicit in present and future Israeli war crimes. There's been hardly any American mention of the Palestinians' plight during a week of vicious Israeli bombardment of Gaza. For years, polls have highlighted the overwhelming Arab support for Palestine as the foremost Arab cause, and the growing hostility towards America, which is seen as a destabilizing hegemonic force in the region.
There is the possibility that if the war really widens not only to include Gaza, but maybe the West Bank, that it will not only alienate Arab allies, but could potentially lead to a breaking of relations with Israel.
First of all, Biden is unwelcome here because he has a major role in this game, a major role in the aggression on our people, and he is providing the money and weapons to kill our people in Gaza and everywhere.
The long history of U.S. military aid to Israel has helped the regime develop its military prowess, and it continues to represent a significant share of Israel's military budget. Currently, Israel receives $3.8 billion in military aid from the U.S. annually, under a memorandum signed in 2019.
Instead, what we have seen is that Israel has been allowed to do whatever it wants when it comes to killing Palestinians, when it comes to stealing Palestinian land, when it comes to ethnic cleansing, when it comes to crossing the red lines that are enshrined in international law. Israel's allowed to get away with it, and not only get away with it, but continues to receive support and financial support from the United States as well.
That accounted for about 16% of Israel's total military budget in 2022. The U.S. has strong historical and economic ties to Israel. The U.S. is Israel's top trading partner, with annual bilateral trade of nearly $50 billion in goods and services. Unprecedented admission. An Israeli official admitting that war crimes will be committed in the face of the international community and the world. War crime number one, referring to Palestinians as human shields that need to be killed. War crime number two, a complete siege of the Gaza Strip, no water, food, or electricity. And war crime number three, the forced displacement of Palestinians. The Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, true to his word, has closed off the Strip completely, while the bloodshed continued. Palestinians have been slaughtered and murdered, especially children. But Israeli anti-Palestinian sentiment has even gone beyond hatred, if that is even possible. Take Zippy Navan, a close advisor to Netanyahu's wife. She posted outrageous remarks on Facebook, saying that it was not enough to flatten Gaza. She said the culprits should be captured and tortured one by one by pulling out their nails and skinning them alive. Her reference was to the false reports that resistance fighters from Hamas had committed those crimes, part of the disinformation campaign that Western media had reported.
Soldiers told me they believe 40 babies, children, were killed.
The Israeli Prime Minister's spokesman just confirmed babies and toddlers were found with their heads decapitated in Kfar Aza.
The lie was so severe that it had forced apologies, like U.S. media giant CNN and its presenter. What is significant here is not the apology, not that it does not matter, but the source of the fake news, that it was the office of the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu who had distributed the fake news. The Israeli war on Gaza has risked throwing the region into a war to open several fronts: Hezbollah and resistance groups in Lebanon, Iraq's Kataib Hezbollah, Yemeni fighters, and also Syria, all possibilities. And Iran. Hossein Salami, the commander-in-chief of the IRGC, relayed his views on Hamas' fighting capacity. Today, according to everyone's admission, the Zionist regime has not only suffered defeat, but also humiliation, and Hamas alone, and without relying on any other power, has caused them a great defeat. Iran and Hezbollah are formidable forces, which Israel cannot deal with simultaneously. Israel knows that, and so does Iran. But Israel has to contend with another front, one that may continue beyond the war, and that is the possibility of a civil war within the occupied Palestinian territories. Palestinian deaths in the OPT have increased dramatically since the operation broke out, with over 50 Palestinians killed so far. Moreover, the Israeli regime forces have increased the number of Palestinians it has detained, that number standing at around 70, all of this in a matter of 10 days. Meanwhile, the Israeli far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has encouraged Israelis and settlers to pick up arms against Palestinians, as seen here. He's also directed the purchase of more than 10,000 firearms and weapons for around 26,000 Israeli settlers. This points to how this war will extend inside the OPT, to last even longer than the war on Gaza, thus posing an existential threat to Israel. How the war ends and in what state Israel will be left in is not known. But there's another factor that Israel has to worry about, and it's the economy. It has become increasingly clear that the Israeli economy will have a tough time surviving. The devaluation of the shekel massive investment and capital flight, mass exodus of people, and a rising deficit are all plaguing the economy. The Israeli Central Bank has been forced to withdraw $30 billion from its foreign exchange reserves to prop up the war expenses. Even Israel's Knesset cannot hold a meeting. This session had to be broken up as Knesset lawmakers went for cover while resistance missiles were raining down overhead. So while Israel may claim parts of the Gaza Strip have turned into rubble, Israel itself has suffered the same, all out of its own doing.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this program, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a part of a speech delivered by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the veterans from the Sacred Defense and the Resistance Field. This meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on September 20, 2023, inaugurating Sacred Defense Week. The culture of resistance has become institutionalized in the country over the past 30-plus years due to the 8 years of resistance during the Sacred Defense. Our country is indebted to the Sacred Defense for its continued existence. Some people want to damage it, some create doubts about it, some distort the truth about it, and others tell outright lies about various issues concerning the Sacred Defense. In response to these actions, those who are able to clarify matters should clarify them. We must talk about and clarify the greatness of the sacred jihad and the sacred defense more and more every day. This is one of our duties.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The current activities that are being done, which were reported to us now, are good, but this should be increased 100-fold. We have the capability, we have the resources, and we have the talent. We can make artistic works, we can make good movies, we can write good books, and we can write novels based on real events. We can do these things, but we must also not forget or lose sight of our goal in the process. Sometimes work in the field of the arts is done with the intention of supporting this path, but that's not how it turns out at the end. This is because confusing very thoughts come up on the way that cause people to forget and lose sight of the goal. You need to be mindful of this. Abundance work needs to be done in the field of the arts. Everyone should do this in the way they are capable of doing. What I have said so far today was regarding the sacred defense. But I would like to say a few words about the armed forces, which is also appropriate for today. During the war, our armed forces worked hard, and they truly made